Wow, that was quick. This is really strange for me because normally I'm watching someone else do this and I'm really, really nervous. My name's Louise and I'm an addict. Hi. I know a few of you and a few of you I don't, but for those that I don't know, obviously immediate identification, I've got the same illness as you. It might look a little bit different. Some of our circumstances might be different, but essentially, we share the same issue and also the same solution if you embrace it. I went to a convention in April, and I watched and heard my first sponsor do a chair, and my first sponsor's got like 20-odd years. And he just owned the stage, you know, he was just so confident. He was obviously nervous, but he was funny. And I am not funny. So I'm thinking, you know, what do I say? Am I going to make them laugh? And actually, I've only got one story, so it's probably best if I just kind of stick with that. If you get something out of it, brilliant. And if you don't, then just keep coming back, keep listening to others. You might get something out of what I say, but you'll definitely get something out of someone else, because that's also my experience. So, yeah, I'm really, really nervous. I actually feel quite sick. In April, I celebrated 10 years clean and sober. And I say that because I'm proud of it. Not through ego, obviously, everyone says that. But I think it's really important to show that this actually works. I really was hopeless. I mean, I'm just a totally different person now to what I was back then. I walked into these rooms very codependent. I actually got here because I was with somebody else that needed this. I didn't need it. You know, I was trying to fix somebody else. But in actual fact, you know, I needed to be here myself, and it took me a couple of years to realize that. But when I came here, I was like a really nervous and very quiet person. And I'm not very quiet now, and a lot of people can't imagine me being quiet. You know, I sort of, you know, I will say what I think, and but I was incredibly quiet and a real people pleaser. I didn't really know much about myself at all, and I didn't know that at the time. I thought I was a really kind, caring, helpful person. I didn't think I had a problem with drink or drugs at all. I thought that everybody else had a problem and didn't know how to relate to me. I didn't think I had that issue. I really thought that I was kind of like the best, you know? Like, if everyone could just be like me, it would be all right. And I was just really, really deluded. I come from a large family. I come from Enfield originally, which is North London, and I don't come from the nice bit. It is like, you know, proper council estate. It's full of drugs, full of violence, crime. But it was home, you know, like to me, that was just normal. And I have two brothers, and my mum and dad, they did their best. They absolutely did their best, but they weren't the best parents. My dad's Irish, my mum's Scottish, and they both like to drink, and my mum likes to use as well. And I guess that whilst that didn't make me an addict or an alcoholic, I certainly learned some behaviours from that relationship. Like, I learned that if there was conflict or you disagreed with someone, you used violence to solve it. You know, really unhealthy behaviours. So growing up, I was really full of fear. My parents, my mum especially, was quite violent towards me. And then my older brother would sort of play that out as well. He would kind of copy her and beat the crap out of me. And yeah, it was not really very nice. And I just lived with, very much like I've got right now, a sick feeling in my stomach. I had that constantly. I wet the bed a lot. As a child, I was scared to wet the bed, because I knew I'd get the shit kicked out of me by my mom in the morning if I had. It was like a vicious cycle, you know? It's like, so then, because I was scared, I would do it anyway. And yeah, my mum was very, very angry. I mean, I have better understanding now as to why she was angry, but at the time I thought it was all my fault that I wasn't perfect enough. So I used to kind of escape into books and things like that. Like, I really liked reading. I'd go to the library to get out of the house because it was chaotic, angry, you know, there's a lot of violence. And I would sort of like lose myself in fantasy and books. And then at about 9 years old, I kind of hung around with some of the older kids on the estate because it was a big estate. And I started to smoke weed at nine. Very proud that I had my first joint at nine. I'd already had a drink about six or seven. My grandparents are alcoholics, so drink was around a lot. And I smoked cigarettes from a really young age too. And at the time, I didn't realize I was changing the way that I felt. I didn't know that I was sort of using those things to hide behind or to escape from reality. But I liked it, and I didn't know why. And I just did it, and I hid it as well. I didn't do it with my friends. I actually would go off on my own and walk my dog, and I had one of those things that you wear around your neck to the beach when we were kids. It like kept everything dry, and I'd hide like fags and stuff in there, and I'd go and do it on my own, and I'd smoke grass and really, really sort of strange looking back, but anything. I'd light matches and inhale them as they were igniting, and just anything. And I thought that was normal. I thought all kids did that. Like, but actually now I know that that's not really normal. So yeah, I set fire to my bedroom once. Playing with matches. I just set fire to my bedroom, tried to explain that to my angry mum. But yeah, I was a real tomboy as well. Like, I didn't feel that I fit in with other girls. I now know that I just found it too competitive. And I felt it easier to fit in with boys. So I was always hanging around my little brother. I used to do his head in. I would go fishing with him. We'd go camping. And, you know, it was just great environment to smoke and drink. So, yeah, had no idea absolutely what was wrong with me. Had no idea that this life I lived was actually not that normal. By the age of 13, I ended up in care. I bunked school a lot. I'd go to school with bruises. I had, you know, my mum was very violent, and I had lots of black eyes and things like that. And I'd always get asked often. I'd go to the medical room because I felt sick. I felt sick constantly. I'd go to the medical room complaining I felt sick, and the medical lady in there, who knew part of our family, would say, like, what's really going on? And eventually one day she said to me, like, how did you get your black eye? And I was like, I stood on a rake, because that was my thing. And she's like, what, again? And she's like, you know, you can tell me what happened, but what's really going on? You can trust me, I won't tell anybody. So I was like, okay. And I told her that my mum had punched me in the eye. And she told social services, and I shit myself. Yeah, I shit myself. So where I already felt sick, I felt even more sick, because I got called into the office before the end of school, and they told me that social services had already been in touch with my mom, and I knew what I was going to get when I got home. Anyway, I went home. And my mom was actually quite apologetic, and she said, you know, everything will be all right. But it wasn't. It wasn't all right. She couldn't control her temper, and she threw me out at 13. So, yeah, I wandered the streets. She'd throw me out every night. I was working as a painter and decorator at this point, like you do. You know, I was a proper tomboy, and I wanted money to feed my drinking. You know, go out with my mates and drink and smoke. Smoking wasn't as expensive then as it is now, but it was, you know, still expensive when you're smoking 20 a day. So I was working on a building site, working as a painter and decorator. And one of my friends, actually, her dad was a painter and decorator too. And I started working with him during school holidays. And I started to be late in the mornings working with him. And they asked me why, him and his wife. And I said, you know, I'm just waking up late. And they said, why don't you stay here during the week while you're working? And I was like, okay, fine. And then I went home one day, and both my parents told me they didn't want me to live there at all anymore. And Judy and John, my new mom and dad, they fostered me. So, yeah, so I got a new mom and dad at 13. And that in therapy is really wonky because I'd gone from being a scapegoat in one family to being put on a pedestal in another one. And like, you know, now I've done years of therapy and it's just like, whoa, understanding all of that and how that's messed me up is really strange. But anyway, you know, they took me in and I was really, really grateful because I knew that I was either going to end up in a care home with all of the like really wrong kids, because there was nothing wrong with me, or I was going to be on the streets of London. And I didn't particularly like that idea because I knew I'd end up a heroin addict and I'd be dead within years. So yeah, I was really grateful. I didn't really go to school much after that from the age of 13. And I just kind of like got quite promiscuous. I looked for love in the wrong places. So really for me, my story, whenever I do my chair, is all about men, really. Like my problem was not alcohol and drugs. My problem was relationships. That's what I thought, you know, that's what it looked like to me. And that's probably what it looked like to a lot of people. Although everybody kind of knew that I was, yeah, I drank way too much and used too much. But I just didn't feel loved. I felt so rejected from my family and just so abandoned that I guess I didn't even know it at the time, but I would kind of like go with men just to fill that hole. I had a hole in my soul and I wanted to fill that hole. So so that's what I did. I didn't go to school really anymore. I did 3 GCSEs, and that was only because I didn't have to pay for them. The school didn't think I'd turn up. So I didn't really have much of a future as I saw it. So of course I needed a man. I needed someone to take care of me. I needed like a daddy figure. And I didn't know that that's how it was, but that is how it was. So from that point onwards, really from the age of 13, I just went from relationship to relationship to relationship, and they were all toxic, and they were all violent, and they were all total car crashes. I had no idea how to relate to anybody, and I actually thought the other person was always a problem. So at the age of 17, I got with this guy called Manuel, which always used to make me laugh. He was a chef in London. And he was a fair bit older than me. And he spoke fluent Spanish, so I was determined to learn fluent Spanish when I broke up with him. But while I was with him, I got pregnant. And I knew that this relationship, he was a bit violent, and I knew it wasn't a good relationship to bring a child into. So I ended that pregnancy. And that happened quite a few times, and I'm not proud of that. But in a way, perhaps that's a bit of a blessing. But, you know, I had no regard really for life. I was just so selfish. Like, now, of course, I regret those things, but I had no regard whatsoever. Anyway, Manuel and me, we said adios at some point, although I wasn't a willing, like, you know, I didn't leave willingly. I was so codependent. I mean, like, I didn't want to be with this person, but also I couldn't handle not, you know, the rejection. I didn't know that at the time, but so I would stalk him, and, you know, it was just really messy, really ugly, and he didn't want me. So I decided to move to Spain at that point. Now I'm 20, so I think, right, okay, I'm going to go to Spain, and I'm going to learn Spanish, which I did. I speak fluent Spanish, which I'm quite proud of, because I left for 3 GCSEs, you know, I'm not very clever. That's wrong. I am. I have as much ability as anybody else. But I just, I didn't have the right encouragement. I went to Spain and it was brilliant because, oh God, the drink was just like, there was loads of it and there was loads of drugs. And it was really from the age of 20 that I got introduced to cocaine, and I loved cocaine. What I loved more was alcohol, but cocaine allowed me to just drink even more alcohol and not go into blackout. I did go into blackout eventually, even with cocaine, but in the beginning, you know, my drinking and using didn't really have any consequences. I couldn't see how it played out in my life in terms of how it affected my relationships or how it affected my work or my relationship with myself, you know, like I had no self-respect whatsoever. So if I didn't respect myself or love myself, how could anybody else? You know, you set the bar for how other people treat you. Didn't know that then. But yeah, I loved Spain because it was just free everything, really. And you know what? I'm just a scab. I will just ponce off anybody. Like, and I didn't think I did, but I would take from anybody. If it was free, I was having it. And I used to just avoid paying for everything. And that's quite embarrassing, but it's true. So my boyfriend during most of my time there was Cuban, and he was clearly a cocaine dealer. And we used to have bags of cocaine in the fridge in black rubber bags. And, you know, he had a little son that used to come in the mornings and stay, and we'd be sleeping during the day because we'd work at night. And that cocaine, pure, like a big rock of it, would be in the fridge. And yet we didn't care that that little boy could have grabbed it. You know, I mean, like, that's how selfish I was. And I would think, but he's the drug dealer. You know, I was always pointing my finger at everybody else. You're the one who's wrong. You're the one who's out of order. I didn't work at that point. He used to work in a bar and used to sell it. And I'm like pointing the finger at him. You're a dirty drug dealer. Because he'd call me a borracha. I'm a drunk. He'd call me a drunk. And I'd be like, you're a dirty drug dealer. And I'm at home with a set of scales, weighing it up, bagging it up, delivering it to him. And he's the dealer. It's like, I was a dealer too, you know? And I would use loads of it. And he'd come home and he'd weigh it. And he'd be like, oh, you've done a couple of grams. What's wrong with you? And I'm like, fuck off, you know? It was just chaos, you know? And he broke my nose. And, it was a really volatile relationship. And that's what my relationships looked like. And you know what? So that was early, you know, that's my early 20s, and it just got worse and worse and worse. So we know how crappy it is, and, you know, I couldn't stop drinking and using, and I didn't know that. I thought I chose to do it, but I couldn't stop. My life was totally unmanageable. It was a total bloody mess, but I couldn't see it. And, of course, I blamed everybody else, except I would never look at me and see that I was part of the problem. I left Spain. I'll say I left, I ran away because I stole all his money and he was chasing me. I jumped on a plane and just, you know, geographicals, I'd done so many of those. I left Spain stole all his money, put holes in every single piece of clothing that he had, including even the Hoover, like, because he was with someone else. I mean, just so vengeful, so angry. I went to Suffolk, where my foster parents by this time had moved. In Suffolk, I don't know if anyone's ever been there, but I went to a little town called Beccles and a little town called Bungay, and they are tiny. Everybody knows everybody, and there's me like a whirlwind from London, sleeping with people's boyfriends. I mean, like, just creating total carnage. And all the women hated me, and the men thought I was great because I was a new face, and I loved it. And of course, I got more free drink and loads of free drugs. And yeah, I just wrecked people's lives, and I didn't even care. I was just, yeah, really angry. And if anyone ever said anything to me, I was like, sorry. I was like, fuck you. Do you know what I mean? Fuck you. You've got the problem. I'm fighting all the time. Oh my God, literally flying over the bar. I used to run pubs in those areas, and, you know, I'd be more drunk than anybody. I'd be falling down the cellar steps and telling people to get out of my pub, like Peggy, get out of my pub at 7 o'clock. And my new boyfriend, another victim, would be like, Louise, it's only 7 o'clock. It's not even closing time yet. And I'm just so out of it. I don't even know or care. And then I'm snogging someone else in front of him because I've had something. I don't even know what I've taken. Someone's given me some drugs and I don't even know what it is. And I'm just out of it. And yeah, you know, just horrible, horrible. Now this guy, he doesn't beat me. I beat him, you know. I give him a fat lip because he isn't doing what I want. And of course we break up. But it was really at that point that I started to see that perhaps there was something wrong with me. We've still got a few more years. But yeah, you know, I went to hypnotherapy to try and get better. It didn't work. It didn't work. I eventually left Suffolk. I got a job. I sort of started a career. And I put down men because I thought men are definitely my problem. Not drink or drugs. Men are my problem. And I moved to Enfield and I got a really good job, actually. Really enjoyed it. There was a lot of drink. It was just really acceptable. I mean, when I went to my interview, I was smashed off my head from the night before still. I'd had loads of cocaine with my auntie, because that's normal, isn't it? It was my nan's funeral. Yeah, I was still off my face. And they thought that was great. It was recruitment-based. And, yeah, so I got offered the job and fit in straight away. But that led on to much better things. But that sort of stop in the relationships was temporary. The drinking continued, the using continued. I'm living a double life. I'm like the Jekyll and Hyde that's described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't want either of my lives to collide. People at work are like, what did you do last night? I'm like, I didn't do anything. You know, I was just trying to hide everything. And it's really getting quite difficult because I'm going out drinking and using near to where I work. So, you know, it's quite difficult to conceal it when it's very close by. Anyway, I met this guy during that job, and he was so naughty looking. You know, he was a real bad boy, and I knew him. I knew him from a building site I'd worked on when I was a teenager. And our eyes met across the bar. He asked me for my number. We went out on a date. He told me he'd just come out of prison. I was like, oh my God. And I was like, oh, it's okay, I can change him. Codependent. You know, he was worse than me. Everybody was worse than me in my eyes. Anyway, he had a problem with heroin, and I had no idea about addiction. Do you know what I mean? I was like, okay, everyone deserves a second chance. And anyway, he still had this problem. And we spent a few years together. And we had a business, and I left my job. I got sacked from my job. He used to come and spy on me. It was just so chaotic and ugly, you know, the whole thing. It was just a total mess. But the best thing that ever happened was he met a girl in these rooms. He met a newcomer. I say that's the best thing that ever happened. The best thing was that he came into these rooms. He tried to get clean and sober in CA, and he did, he achieved it. And so then I knew about this stuff, you know, and it was like, what is this stuff? And he had been 12-stepped by somebody that he'd known from childhood, who I knew was a total lunatic. And this person was like really sane and normal, and I was like, wow, like what is this stuff? What is... So this guy, he tells my then partner about CA, and he starts to go, and I start to look at the Big Book. I start to study the Big Book, actually, thinking, I understand it. I've got no idea. You know, you need a sponsor, somebody who understands it to take you through it. But I thought I kind of understood it, and I was trying to fix this person, but also I didn't want to be with him. Even work that one out. Anyway, he did get clean and sober. He met a newcomer. He went off with her, and we split up. And I was like 40 grand in debt, and I just had a breakdown. I was left with nothing. I had nothing. I had no food in the fridge. My dogs, I couldn't feed my dog or my cats. And I was smoking and drinking, and I had to choose between alcohol or tobacco, and I chose alcohol. I just lost it. Just went into sort of autopilot. And had people ringing me and knocking at the door looking for money, and I had nothing. Anyway, I eventually managed to get a job sort of in autopilot. I went back to my old career, and over the 2 years that followed, I paid off all of that debt, paid off every single penny, because although I wasn't working the program or in the program, I knew about the amends and stuff like that, and I knew how much that could make me feel free. During those 2 years, I hounded my ex-partner's sponsor, ringing him up, going, he's out or whatever. And his sponsor would just keep saying to me, Louise, do you not think that maybe you might need some help? Like, have you thought about going to meetings? And I'm like, no, why would I? And he directed me to Al-Anon. And I walked in there and said, in Hartford, sleepy Hartford, with like five older ladies and said, yeah, my partner's a heroin addict. And they were like, they just looked at me like I had two heads. But yeah, you know, it wasn't really for me at the time because obviously I wasn't open to it. I wanted to find a way to kind of get him back or get at him. I didn't want to heal myself and I didn't realize that was what it was for. Anyway, 2 years after we split up, I started to rebuild my life on the outside. And I've got a really good job now. I've got a car, I've got a flat, I've paid off all that debt. And I just want to fucking die. I just hated myself. I'm drinking against my will. I'm using against my will. I'm dreading the weekends because I know that I'm just going to be on my own drinking all weekend. I don't go out anymore because I fight all of the time and I piss people off and I am just a total mess. And also I'm scared because I know that, you know, I've come to in blackout and I used to think I was asleep, but I wasn't asleep. In blackout, I would be doing stuff and I'd come to and be like, who the hell are you? And they would look at me very confused, like, what do you mean? And it scared me to think that, you know, some bad stuff happened to me, obviously, while I was drinking and using anyway, but it could have got so much worse and it scared me. So I used to drink alone at home. Yeah, it was ugly. And I'd go into work and I had a good job and I'd go, hi, morning, and pretend that, you know, that everything was fine. And I'd keep my distance so people couldn't smell the drink or anything on me, but I hated myself. Anyway, one morning I was driving to work. I had, I don't know, I used to start work at 7 in the morning and I probably drank until about, I don't know, the early hours anyway. And I was just screaming in the car, doing 100 miles an hour on the M25, and I just wanted to end it. I just had enough. I just really had enough. I could not see the point of my life. I was 35. I was single. Like, none of the things that I thought I wanted, the job, the flat, they didn't make me happy. They didn't fill that hole in my soul. So something happened to me in the car that morning. All of a sudden, I had sort of a bit of a thing about, I don't know, I tasted whiskey and roll-ups, and I hadn't smoked for 2 years at this point, and I hadn't drank whiskey. I'd had God knows what else, you know, vodka and all that, but I hadn't had whiskey, but that was my dad's thing, whiskey and roll-ups. And I just thought, I think I might have a problem. You know, it just took me so long to realise, and people told me I was a drunk and I was a junkie and I was this and I was that, but I'd just tell them to, you know, F off. It was only when I realised that there was a problem that I could actually be accepting of a solution, I guess, but I had to understand the problem first. So I didn't end it, obviously, because I'm here. What I did do was I reached out to my ex-partner's sponsor and said, I think I've got a problem with drinking drugs. And he called me at 7 in the morning and he says, what do you mean, Lou? And I was like, well, you know, and he got me to talk about it. And I said, well, you know, I think I've probably got a problem with drinking drugs. And yeah, you know, I want to die. And Tom said to me, Lou, he says, if you want, he says, I can take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and we can start from the beginning. And he said, and if you just do exactly what I say, then you don't never need to drink or use again. And you don't never need to feel like this ever again. And I was just like, oh my God, now I'm really analytical and that drives my husband mental. And he would tell you that, oh, she just overanalyzes everything. But I just took that at face value and I just went with that. I was like, okay, I'll just do whatever you say. And I did. Pretty much. I listened, you know, like I've really clung on to that hope that someone else is going to guide me in what I need to do next to change my life, because my choice was die or try something different. I was coming close. So I did, and Tom, who did actually become my sponsor, he wasn't sponsoring my ex at this point, he said to me, just get to a meeting every day, get on your knees, pray, and just listen. And I did, and I turned up at his house every week, and we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went through the first 160, I can't even remember. We went through the doctor's opinion, and I heard about what alcoholism is. I thought I knew what an alcoholic and an addict was. I thought it was someone who was on a park bench and their life had ended and they were going to die. And so, of course, I didn't want to be that. But what I learned was, it's somebody who, once they start, they cannot stop. Once they put a substance, mind-altering substance in them, they cannot stop. And I identified with that. I didn't identify with someone on a park bench. I mean, I was on my own bench in my living room, right? But I couldn't see that. I needed someone to show me how these words in this book related to my life and what that looked like in my life. And I think the biggest thing for me was step one, you know, and it actually took me quite a few years to understand step one fully. Understanding that my life is unmanageable and that I'm powerless. I didn't know what that looked like for me, even though I'd say that I've done the steps. For the first few years of my recovery, because I am recovered from a hopeless state of mind. For the first few years, I was like, I don't know, really. I didn't understand that step. And it was another sponsor that took me through the work that said to me, do some written work about what unmanageability looks like in your life and what powerlessness looks like in your life. And so I had to give some examples. And it really, really helped me. So, like, you know, like, wetting the bed, you know. I haven't wet the bed in 10 years. I've been sober for 10 years. I haven't wet the bed, but I used to wet the bed a lot then. Obviously, I lost control of my body. Not turning up for work, promising to be somewhere and not turning up, losing jobs, saying I'm not going to drink and use again and doing it anyway. You know, I drank every single day from the age of 13. I drank every single day up until the age of 35, every day. So, I really had to look at what that meant in my life, because it's a really good reminder, and I keep that piece of paper. It's a really good reminder of what I've got to go back to. And in actual fact, that's not what I'll go back to. It will be worse if I decide to pick up a drink or drug again. Step two and three were a little bit of a problem for me because I didn't think I was insane. I thought I was quite normal. So again, I needed to be shown what that looked like in my life. But I didn't believe in God. Like, you know, no, there is no God that would allow me to go through all the things I've been through. You know, I was like, oh, poor me, I've been in care, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't believe in God. And there was definitely no God in my house growing up. And that, I was thinking about that earlier. That reminds me of something someone else said to me where they're like, you know, God is in my house. I love that. But I had a real problem with that. So getting on my knees and doing step three with my sponsor, I was like, I ain't doing that. But of course, I'd already said I would do anything I was told. So I had to. Like today, I didn't want to be here, but I said I'd be here. So I have to be here. That's something I've learned, you know, commitment and loyalty through doing this work. So I did, you know, my sponsor got on his knees first and started to pray to this God that I did not understand. And was like, God, please help Lou. And I can't even remember exactly what he said, but he started getting upset and he started crying. And I was like, what on earth is this? And it really freaked me out. But I just kind of went with it. And then it was my turn and I just prayed to God, like, God, please help me. I don't know what, you know, I'm just messing everything up. And then I just, the floods just opened and I was just crying and I just got really honest. And I think that's something my program is really based on today, is like honesty. I was so dishonest my whole life. And the person I was most dishonest to was actually myself. And I never knew it. And I really, really use that as, like, I guess the keystone of my program now. If I am dishonest in any way, like any tiny, tiny little way, I know I'm going to end up drinking or using, and I cannot afford to be dishonest. But yeah, step three, I got honest and I prayed to a God I didn't understand. But do you know what? Everything changed for me from that moment. I started to see the beauty in the world around me, the green of the trees, the blue of the sky, the white of the clouds. And I didn't feel alone anymore. I didn't believe in God still, but I was willing to believe. That's all I'm asked to do, is to be willing to believe. This isn't a religious program, you know. You don't have to believe in God. And whatever your God is to you is your own version of God or high power. But yeah, I no longer felt alone, and I'd felt alone my whole life, you know, and I felt like I'd been fighting my whole life. I've been angry my whole life, and all of a sudden, not only do I feel that I've got something bigger than me with me, I can just hand it over. Like, that was so freeing for me, knowing that my God, my higher power, whatever that is in control and not me. I am not supposed to be in control of everything, and nor can I be. But I am meant to be one of God's children, playing happily, enjoying life, feeling unconditionally loved in God's playground. And God takes care of all the other stuff. You know, just handing that crap over and just asking for God to align me to his will or her will and not my own. That was just so freeing. Yeah, step four and five were really revealing to me, obviously. I found out that I'm incredibly selfish. I'm not a nice person. By default, I'm not a nice person. Like I said, I don't want to be here. I am really selfish. But but I am. I've been taught in this program to do the opposite of what my head tells me. And I often do that. Sometimes I don't. I also have, you know, I say that my God is kind of inside of me, in my soul, which is in my sort of tummy region. That's what it feels like. And when that little voice in there is saying, no, 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 don't do it, don't do it. And I do it anyway, and I listen to my head or my false ego, my false self. I always regret it. You know, my God lives in here, and that quiet voice is the one I should listen to. Four and five were really revealing. I found out that my mum does love me. I thought she didn't. She does love me. She did the very, very best that she could. But my expectations are my problem. She didn't love me the way I expected her to. And an expectation is a resentment in the making, I found out. So, yeah, I found out a lot about myself in four and five. And six and seven are obviously ongoing. I pray for God to remove my defects, but I need to be able to do something about it as well. I can't just wait for them to be removed. I'm a person of action. Sometimes I'm not, but I have to be doing something, you know. I have to make things tangible. So somebody said to me, it's not about just waiting for God to remove your defect. It's about finding out what the opposite to that defect is. So if I'm feeling selfish, I should be selfless. If I am feeling unhappy, I should be happy. You know, I should just do the opposite to what I want to do. And then in the background, God or my higher power will take away the defect and I practice the asset. And I found out I've got loads of assets. You know, I am actually a really kind person. It's just I was sick, you know. I was really sick and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had a spiritual problem and I needed a spiritual solution, which I found in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I could never have done it on my own. I had obviously my higher power, but more importantly, you lot, you know, when I hated myself and I didn't feel that I belonged anywhere, you lot hugged me and kept me here, you know. Someone said to me once, don't keep coming back, stay. And that's probably the best advice I ever got. And I intend to stay. I want to keep staying. I don't want to keep coming back. I just want to stay. Today, my life is totally different to what it was back then. And I know I haven't spoke too much about the program, and I apologize for that. I'm nervous and I've rambled. But I live my life to the very best of my ability now. And one of the things I live by is to be honest and to harm no one. And I do harm people, of course I do. I'm human, you know. But I do my best not to, and I apologise, you know, I make amends where I need to. And it's hard to say sorry when you're always right, right? But I'm learning, I'm not always right, and I don't know everything. And my way is not always the best way, and I definitely don't know what's best for me. Today, I love prayer and meditation, you know, and I need to meditate to feel grounded. I need to speak to God in prayer and listen to God's direction in meditation. I need to spread this message as much as I can in every area of my life. Today I'm married. I married a lovely man who I met in these rooms, and we've never seen each other drink or use. He's 12 years clean and sober. I have a home that's clean, it's safe, it's healthy-ish, you know, we're still working on that. We're a couple of addicts, you know, there's going to be issues, but I don't live in a place that I came from. You know, I have created my own family, I've created my own safe environment. All the things I craved were all here within me. I was able to create them once I became empowered enough and believed in myself enough to do it. I always end on this. When one of the biggest things I've done in my recovery, and gosh, I use the serenity prayer a lot. You know, God grant me a serenity, accept the things I cannot change. I change what I can, and I walk away from what I absolutely can't. It took me a long time to learn that. When I was in foster care, I was abused by my foster dad. And one of my amends was to tell someone about that. And of course, I cracked myself. I didn't want to do that. My sponsor was like, you know, you actually have no part to play in this. You've done nothing wrong. This was the one amends where I'd actually done nothing wrong. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I had to do something about it to protect others. So I went to police, social services. He was arrested, court case, found other victims. He went to prison. And that was the hardest thing ever because I didn't want to do it. But God, I'm so proud, you know, and it's not something that I've talked about in detail in meetings, but people have carried me, you know, I've spoken to people after meetings about it. And I think thinking about it today, the only reason I was able to do that was that I heard one other woman a few years ago talk about that in one of the meetings at the Priory, and she spoke without shame, you know, and I was like, oh my God, because I always felt like what had happened was my fault. So that kind of gave me the courage to do it. And now that I'm able to share that without any, you know, emotion, I'm healed from it. It's like I'm really healed from it. I know other women and even men that have gone on to do the same, you know. So whilst it's an uncomfortable subject, there are some people that need to know that, you know, you will be believed. Yeah, I am an incredibly happy member of this fellowship. And I will keep staying, and I hope someone got something from my waffling. And if they didn't, I apologize. Just stay and keep listening to someone else. I'll leave it there. Thank you.